everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, political Zionism versus religious Judaism. This is a topic that does not get the type of attention or in-depth discussion or debate or dialogue that it deserves. Virtually every U.S. senator voted in full support of an Israeli resolution. Not one was willing to challenge them. Why? What hold do the Israeli parliamentarians, APEC, their organization that represents them in the United States and others, what power do they hold? Even a reasonable person would suggest that it is important that both the Palestinians' needs to have some sovereignty and self-reliance, the ability to conduct commerce and live normal and quality lives, is equally important as that for the Jewish people. Why isn't that happening? It hasn't happened. We're going to discuss that. My first guest in this discussion will be Robert Perry. He is one of our leading progressive investigative journalists, best known for his upcoming Iran-Contra story and Oliver North's involvement, which earned him the George Polk Award for National Reporting. He is currently the senior editor and writes for Consortium News. Robert has covered many important stories, including breaking the first story about the Nicaraguan Contra cocaine connection in 1985, as well as right-wing terrorism, the demise of American media, the Bush and Obama presidencies, and the rise and influence of the neocons in our wars overseas. In the past, he's worked as a journalist for the Associated Press, PBS Frontline, and Newsweek. He's written several books, his latest being America's Stolen Narrative, From Washington to Madison to Nixon, Reagan, and the Bushes to Obama. His website is consortiumnews.com. In the second part of our program, we will be joined by a leading rabbi, Rabbi Weiss. He's an American rabbi, human rights and religious activist, and a spokesperson for the Nidore Karita, also known as the Orthodox Jews United Against Zionism, in Brooklyn and Monsey, New York. This group is opposing the State of Israel and the Zionist agenda that pretends to be representative of the spiritual values in religious Judaism and the Torah. It was founded in Jerusalem in 1938 when a group of Orthodox rabbis refused to recognize the authority of what would later become the State of Israel. Rabbi Weiss is the son of Hungarian Jews. Both of his grandparents died at the Auschwitz camp during World War II. He is also a sharp critic of the Jewish and Israeli efforts to use the Holocaust as a weapon to increase sympathy for political and economic advantage. He's highly respected within the Muslim and Palestinian communities for his efforts to advance interfaith dialogue between religions. The rabbi's writings can be found at his website, nkusa.org. Also, time permitting, in the second hour of our program, we will take you to the West Bank, where for one hour approximately, you will hear from a woman who's lived there as a part of a human rights effort to try to see what she and their group can do to help with some of the suffering of the Palestinian civilians, women and children particularly, who have suffered. It is a important story because rarely do we hear from that perspective. Let's start in Washington, D.C. with Robert Perry. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for having me.
3 years ago, a Pew Charitable Research survey found that 62% of conservative American Jews and 72% of secular Jews are critical of Netanyahu and the Israeli right's treatment and policies towards Palestinians. Only about 10% of American Jews, largely from the Orthodox contingent, agree with Israel's actions. But then again, many Orthodox Jews in America oppose their action also. And this group in Israel refuses to acknowledge a Palestinian state. They fully support the settlements and view the region as land promised to Jews only by God. This is the group that is supported by 55% of American Christians. much more than Jews themselves, which is where we should examine this. Why would American Christians be more supportive than American Jews? And also, where they differ is on the Israeli government's policies towards Palestinians. However, today we have an extremely powerful Jewish pro-Israeli Zionist lobby in Washington, AIPAC, A-I-P-A-C, that portends to represent the demands of all American Jewry. So please take your time and speak about the influence of AIPAC, what it does in Washington, and the control it has over our politicians, irrespective of the carnage on the ground, and how much influence they have over the Obama administration. And finally, on this issue, what are some AIPAC's tactics to win influence over American legislators? The forum is yours.
Well, AIPAC is certainly a very powerful, well-organized lobby. They're perhaps the most effective lobby we have in the United States. You could argue that some of the gun lobby is very, very important. In the past, you might look at the China lobby, which wielded a great deal of influence back in the 1950s. But AIPAC has been able to use the support that it has from a significant part of the Jewish community across the country to raise money for politicians who will do its bidding. I was once told by a senior staffer of a fairly prominent member of Congress who had never really run in races that were that competitive, but he finally found himself in a new district, and he suddenly had to raise money to fight for his seat. And his staffer put a call into the head of AIPAC at the time and said, you know, my congressman's having some trouble, and literally within days, large sums of money came in from various individuals from around the country that were simply tasked by AIPAC to give money to this congressman. The congressman was able to use that money to help beat back his opposition. And we've seen this very strategic use of campaign funding by AIPAC to get its way. And when members of Congress have stepped out of line, people like Paul Findlay of Illinois and Chuck Percy, who was a senator from Illinois, when they stepped out of line back, this is going back into the 70s and 80s, early on in this process, and they stepped out of line for fairly modest reasons. They wanted to reach out to see if there could be some way of working with members of the Palestinian leadership to try to bring about some kind of resolution of the conflict there. But at that time, there was this prohibition in effect that politicians could not deal with the PLO, and so when these members of Congress made modest contacts with the PLO to see if there was a way to work things out, they were targeted, their opponents were given large sums of money, and they were defeated. And essentially, they were turned into pariahs. And that's what we've seen over and over and over again. And over time, there has been there's that combination of factors. There's fear. And then there's also a sense that if you're on the right side of AIPAC, life goes much more easily for you that as a politician. And this applies to people who aren't even just running for office. We saw just this weekend where not AIPAC, but another Zionist group took out a full-page ad in the New York Times on Saturday to essentially demonize Sidney Blumenthal, who was a longtime personal friend and aide to Hillary Clinton, and Blumenthal's son, Max Blumenthal, and essentially demand that Hillary Clinton disassociate herself from them because they have criticized some of the practices of the Netanyahu government. And while this may seem minor to some people, the idea of having someone who is an aide, has a fragile, in a sense, relationship with a politician. A person can either be shut out or brought in, and politicians don't really like much controversy in most cases. So this sort of approach is kind of McCarthyistic in that it's a guilt by association. It tries to force someone like a Clinton to disassociate from someone like this, like Blumenthal, and then to use that as a way of showing that the success of this tactic to further and further marginalize people who criticize some aspects of what the Israeli government's doing. And we've seen it play out politically. Just yesterday, several of the remaining candidates for the presidency, I think I see four of them, I guess, showed up at APEC conference, including Donald Trump, including Secretary Clinton, and also Cruz and Kasich. They all of them profess their love and adoration for Israel. I went through the speeches by Clinton and Trump in particular, and it was pandering. There was outright complete pandering where there was no criticism of anything Israel has done, no sense that the Palestinians deserved anything as human beings. It was simply one-sided presentation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with the demands all being that how tough we must be against not just the Palestinians but the Iranians and other groups that the Israelis have targeted as their enemies. So that's what you get. You get this groveling, this pandering, even from senior people running for president, because there's this fear that if you offend AIPAC, they can create enough controversy about you and attack you effectively through their various means and through their connections with the media and so forth, that it's just not worth the fight. The one person, ironically, who did not attend AIPAC was the one Jewish candidate for president, Senator Sanders. He had a conflict. He was out west, competing in these primaries that are being held today. But he gave a speech in Salt Lake City, and he said, "This is the same speech I would have given if I had been able to go to the AIPAC conference." And while he was much more nuanced, he obviously defended Israel's right to exist and its right to have security, but he also spoke about the needs of the Palestinian people and the responsibility of the various players in the region to respect that and to try to bring about some kind of peaceful resolution of this long-standing, festering conflict. So it was ironic that we saw from the one Jewish candidate who actually had lived in Israel, Sanders worked on a kibbutz as a young man in Israel, he had a more subtle, more sensitive understanding of the problem and presented it in a much more nuanced way, whereas what you saw, especially from Clinton and Trump, was what I call a pander-off. They just basically each tried to out-pander the other in terms of saying how much they loved Israel and everything that was going on there. So you had this. So the effect is that over time, it may be somewhat illusory in that I'm not sure that if someone did stand up to AIPAC, I think they probably could do okay. I think there are enough Americans, and as you pointed out, many Jewish Americans who are very concerned about the way the Netanyahu government has functioned. They are not enamored of the treatment of the Palestinians, and they do see it as a blight, not just on the Middle East, but on the whole tradition of Judaism, which is a very thoughtful religion, one that stresses rationality and the common human aspects of life. So you have many people who are very much deeply believing in Judaism who are offended by this, the way that the Netanyahu regime and other of the right-wing Israeli governments going back decades have treated the Palestinians, have treated people in Lebanon, have treated people in the region, where there have been these very brutal, excessive attacks, often in response to sort of tit-for-tat kind of border conflicts. But instead of dealing with it in a proportional way or trying to resolve these other problems, that is, finding a homeland or having a way for this the Palestinian people to have their own state or have some kind of joint state with Israel or something. Instead, there is this effort to what the Israelis call mowing the grass. Mowing the grass means to sort of periodically go out there and kill a bunch of Palestinians or people in Lebanon and use that as a way to intimidate them into being quiescent. And once they, if they, after they are being mistreated, you know, economically in terms of their inability to travel, being sort of essentially locked into some of these places like Gaza, when then they start getting riled up again and start doing, you know, crazy bad things like shooting off rockets or something, then they mow the grass again. They kill another 1,500 or so. So that kind of behavior is very offensive to many people of the Jewish faith who are embarrassed that Israel has been behaving that way. And it's offensive to many people who simply have a concern about humanity. There's a fear, there's a palpable fear in official Washington and in the media that if you're seen as being too critical of Israel, you're called anti-Israel or anti-Semitic, you're sort of smeared, your chances of getting published if you're a journalist or keeping a job becomes more tenuous. You might lose your job or not get a promotion or be sort of shoved aside, marginalized. And for politicians, they may face these angry activists, pro-Israeli activists, who will come out to their town meetings and disrupt things and attack them and call them names. And most politicians simply don't want to go through that. And so they have essentially bent to the will of AIPAC and to the demands from Netanyahu. Netanyahu, by the way, has been invited three times to speak to a joint session of Congress. No other leader in history, except for Winston Churchill, has been afforded that kind of honor. So, if you've watched those speeches, and Netanyahu is quite good at them, he's had a lot of practice, he treats them like a presidential State of the Union address. Even he points to people in the galleries and has all these very touching stories to tell. The members of Congress jump up and down, and they're more effusive in their applause of Netanyahu than they are of the U.S. president at these events. And, you know, that's sometimes you'll see the Republicans sitting on their hands for a Democrat and the Democrats sitting on their hands for a Republican. But in this case, both sides of the aisle, they're jumping up and applauding and cheering this foreign leader who has often engaged in positions that have been counter to what the U.S. government has wanted done. The last time Netanyahu appeared, he came to essentially attack President Obama for trying to negotiate an agreement with Iran and other world powers to constrain Iran's nuclear program. So you have this extraordinary situation where in many cases a leader of a foreign country is given more courtesy and more respect than the leaders of the United States. Anyway, that's sort of how it's developed over the years, and that's where we stand today.
Robert, let's listen to Hillary Clinton at AIPAC. It's only a minute long, but what she said.
That America can't ever be neutral when it comes to Israel's security or survival. We can't be neutral when rockets rain down on residential neighborhoods, when civilians are stabbed in the street, when suicide bombers target the innocent. Some things aren't negotiable. And anyone who doesn't understand that has no business being our president. That's why I believe we must take our alliance to the next level. I hope a new 10-year defense memorandum of understanding is concluded as soon as possible to meet Israel's security needs far into the future. That will also send a clear message to Israel's enemies that the United States and Israel stand together, united. It's also why, as president, I will make a firm commitment to ensure Israel maintains its qualitative military edge.
Now, can you address the amount of support, military or otherwise, that the U.S. provides to Israel? And I ask this because APEC seemingly never feels enough is being given to the Israeli government and its military. And again, it is only the American Orthodox Jewish faction and evangelical Christians who believe that U.S. taxpayers don't give enough. On the other hand, 54% of American Jews believe we give the right amount, and 22% of American Jews say we give too much. So when we hear Hillary Clinton speaking at the recent APEC conference and suggesting that as president, Israel can have practically any support from the U.S. that it demands, what kind of support is she referring to?
Well, for many years, the United States has given about $3 billion a year to Israel for its for various needs. There's a request from the Israelis to up that to $4 billion. Beyond that, there's the Israelis have been given a great deal of intelligence assistance. They've been given some of the highest end American armaments, which they have used sometimes illegally, really, in the sense that these weapons were not meant to be used against civilian populations. They weren't meant to be used as against these occupied areas of they're essentially under Israeli control. They were meant to defend Israel if it's attacked externally. But of course, Israel feels it can pretty much do what it wants because no politician or very few politicians would dare ever cross them or say they can't do it. What was I think most troubling about Secretary Clinton's speech, and it's also true, by the way, of Mr. Trump's speech, was that there was virtually nothing in those speeches that suggested any sympathy for the plight of the people of Palestine, the Palestinians. There was nothing about the fears that the Palestinian parents have when their kids go out on the street, or in the case a year or so ago, when some children were playing on a beach and the Israelis blew them up with rockets, I guess thinking they were some kind of terrorists or something. They were just, you know, young children. So when you have this kind of disproportionate slaughter of Palestinians, while it certainly is reprehensible that people would attack Israeli citizens as well, or civilians especially, the idea that that the sympathy only goes in one direction is quite shocking, frankly. And that's the way, if you've not just heard that one section, but if you read the entire speech that Secretary Clinton gave and the speech that Mr. Trump gave, you will be hard-pressed to find anything in there that suggests that the Palestinian people are deserving of anything. There's one point even when Mr. Trump says that he says there's no moral equivalence because the people of the Palestinians name public squares after terrorists. As I point out in this piece I put up this afternoon, if actually you go back and look in Israeli history, the Israelis have named a lot of streets and squares and public buildings after terrorists. And not just that, they had of course the Stern Gang, and they had other terror groups that operated to try to create Israel back in the 1940s, which included blowing up the King David Hotel and assassinating British officials. So you had this history of terrorism, and many of those Israelis became heroes. And two of them, Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, were elevated to become their prime ministers. So the idea that there's only that all the bad is on the side of the Palestinians, and that the Israelis are innocent and their hands are clean, is simply not correct. It's historically wrong, but it's the way these politicians feel they must present themselves if they're going to be successful. Their fears are that they're going to be, I guess, attacked for various things like being anti-Semitic or anti-Israel if they don't toe the line. So they go out and toe the line. And that's what's, I think, quite disturbing, at least I think for many Americans. And I think many Jewish Americans find this failure to show sympathy to for the Palestinian people and invest all that sympathy in the Israeli people as something that is very hostile to the fundamental ideas of Judaism.
Robert, I want to complete this segment here with a difference of how the conflicts in Israel are covered. The American media was universally supportive of Israel, even though over 100,000 people in Gaza lost their homes. The devastation, it looked like something out of World War II in Breslin. Now, plus over 1,400 innocent civilians, over 500 children killed. Not a word from the American legislators, not from the cabinet, not from the president, not from the House or Senate. But go to England, including a leading Zionist who had enough. And here are some of their responses to that conflict at that time. And compare what they're saying, how they're saying it, to the fact that we were virtually someone hit the mute button in Congress when this last conflict occurred.
Sir Gerald Kaufman.
Madam Deputy Speaker, I was brought up as an Orthodox Jew and a Zionist. On a shelf in our kitchen was a tin box of the Jewish National Fund, into which we put coins to help the pioneers building a Jewish presence in Palestine. I first went to Israel in 1961, and I've been there since more times than I can count. I had family in Israel, and I have friends in Israel. One of them fought in the wars of 1956, 1967, and 1973, and was wounded in two of them. The tie-clip which I'm wearing is made from a campaign decoration awarded to him, which he presented to me. I've known most of the prime ministers of Israel, starting with the founding prime minister, David Ben-Gurion. Golda Meir was my friend. So was Yigal Alon, the deputy prime minister, who as a general won the Negev for Israel in the 1948 War of Independence. My parents came to Britain as refugees from Poland. Most of their families were subsequently murdered by the Nazis in the Holocaust. My grandmother was ill in bed when the Nazis came to her hometown of Staszów. A German soldier shot her dead in her bed. Madam Deputy Speaker, my grandmother did not die to provide cover for Israeli soldiers murdering Palestinian grandmothers in Gaza. The present Israeli government ruthlessly and cynically exploit the continuing guilt among Gentiles over the slaughter of Jews in the Holocaust as justification for their murder of Palestinians. The implication is that Jewish lives are precious, but the lives of Palestinians do not count. On Sky News a few days ago, the spokeswoman for the Israeli army, Major Leibovich, was asked about the Israeli killing of, at that time, 800 Palestinians. The total is now 1,000. She replied instantly, 500 of them were militants. That was the reply of a Nazi. I suppose the Jews fighting for their lives in the Warsaw Ghetto could have been dismissed as militants. The Israeli Foreign Minister, Tzipi Livni, asserts that her government will have no dealings with Hamas because they're terrorists. Tzipi Livni's father was Eitan Livni, chief operations officer of the terrorist Irgun Svai Leumi, who organized the blowing up of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, in which 91 victims were killed, including 4 Jews. Israel was born out of Jewish terrorism. Jewish terrorists hanged 2 British sergeants and booby-trapped their corpses. Irgun, together with the terrorist Stern Gang, massacred 254 Palestinians in 1948 in the village of Deir Yassin. Today, the present Israeli government indicate that they will be willing, in circumstances acceptable to them, to negotiate with the Palestinian President Abbas of Fatah. It's too late for that, Madam Deputy Speaker. They could have negotiated with Fatah's previous leader, Yasser Arafat, who was a friend of mine. Instead, they besieged him in a bunker in Ramallah, where I visited him. It's because of the failings of Fatah since Arafat's death that Hamas won the election, the Palestinian election in 2006. Hamas is a deeply nasty organization, but it was democratically elected, and it is the only game in town. The boycotting of Hamas, including by our own government, has been a culpable error from which dreadful consequences have followed. The great Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eban, with whom I campaigned for peace on many platforms, said, "You make peace by talking to your enemies." However many Palestinians the Israelis murder in Gaza, they cannot solve this existential problem by military means. Whenever and however the fighting ends, there will still be 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza and 2.5 million more Palestinians in the West Bank, who are treated like dirt by the Israelis, with hundreds of roadblocks and with the ghastly denizens of the illegal Jewish settlements harassing them as well. The time will come, not so long from now, when they will outnumber the Jewish population in Israel. It's time for our government to make clear to the Israeli government that its conduct and policies are unacceptable, and to impose a total arms ban on Israel. It is time for peace, but real peace, not the solution by conquest, which is the Israelis' real goal, but which is impossible for them to achieve. They're not simply war criminals, they're fools.
Now, that was but one statement. I have over 20 additional statements we will not play now. You would never hear anything like that from any American legislator. Your final thoughts, Robert Perry?
Well, it is tragic that in the United States we have become so intimidated about discussing reality, discussing what's demonstrably true, because it produces political and career consequences that people do not want to face up to. And there really has to, I'm not sure how you get around it. I think that at some point there has to be some profound courage found in people, average people as well as politicians and journalists and others, to stand up to it. But it's extremely hard to, because you get singled out. I was having dinner with a senior State Department person a while ago, and he said, "You know, your website," he said, "you know, if you keep doing these kinds of things, we'll have to talk about you as being anti-Israel." And it was like, and I'm not anti-Israel, but it's the kind of thing that if you're designated as such, you're considered outside the mainstream, you're marginalized in the United States, and very few people are willing to accept that price. And I think we do need a lot more courage. I would have to say that even though Senator Sanders' speech was, you know, we certainly tried to bend over somewhat backwards to not offend Israel, he certainly expressed a much more nuanced and humanitarian approach than the other four candidates who went to AIPAC. And I think until politicians realize there's a price to pay when they engage in that kind of pandering, that kind of ignoring of the sins of Israel and ignoring the humanity of the Palestinians, I think until there's a price to pay for that, we're going to continue seeing it. So I guess that's my only answer. It's going to require a great deal of courage from a lot of individuals and politicians to stop this. And I think there also has to be recognized that the practical consequences of some of this has been to inspire some of the Islamic extremism that we have seen in the terror attacks that have now gone not just, they've gone obviously against the United States and they've gone against Europe. Many of those people, when they talk, they claim at least that they are inspired to do these horrible things because of the horrible treatment of the Palestinians. So this becomes part of the larger problem, how you solve the issue of terrorism.
Robert Perry, thank you for being on, and people can read your work including America's stolen narrative from Washington to Madison to Nixon, Reagan, and the Bushes to Obama. The website is consortiumnews.com. Appreciate being with us today, Robert.
Thank you.
Robert Perry from Washington, D.C. Now let us go over to Muncie, New York. We're standing by as Rabbi Weiss. Nice to have you with us today, Rabbi Weiss.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We're honored and privileged to be on your show.
I'd given the background on your group and your own background at the introduction of this program, so I want to go right to the issue. And what is concerning to me is that most Americans do not know there's a difference between Zionism and Judaism because they are frequently used interchangeably in our political and media forums. So you just returned from protesting in front of the AIPAC conference at the Washington Convention Center in Washington, D.C., where all the current presidential candidates except Bernie Sanders spoke to the attendees. Trump, Hillary Clinton pledged their support to the State of Israel and the Netanyahu's government. I don't want us to go into the presidential race at all. What is more important is the larger picture that the State of Israel is fundamentally a nation built upon the principles of Zionism. That's what we're told. Started in the late 19th century, and the U.S. government and a large majority of the American public, particularly American Christians, support this state without question or reservations. Yet how many Americans, or even American Jews for that matter, know the true history and background of Zionism, who its founders are, what were their essential principles and philosophy, what was their ultimate mission and why, and what role has Zionism played in the creation of American foreign policy and the shaping of the Middle East? And perhaps even more important, is Zionism truly a representation of the Jewish faith or a perversion thereof, such as Wahhabism is a perversion, distortion, or heresy of Islam? So please take your time and begin by giving a historical summary of Zionism and identify its principal guiding concepts from its creation that continue to guide the activities of the Israeli government and organizations such as AIPAC today. The forum is yours.
First, I pray to the Almighty to bestow upon me his truth, his wisdom, that I may be worthy of conveying his message and so sanctify his name and with the help of the Almighty bring peace to this world, as peace is one of the attributes of God. Shalom, salom, peace. So Judaism is subservience to God, nothing else. Zionism came a mere 100-odd years ago. It's not from way back when. It's a mere 100-odd years, 150 years or so, and they came and they transformed the concept of subservience, instead of subservience to God, that it's a concept of nationalism, that we're a material people, that we have, our goal is to have a piece of land and be strong. They said what we were lacking in the 2,000 years is not that we were banished by God and because we had sinned, but rather because we were physically weak. We didn't have an army. We were lacking. And therefore, never again, they have like their quote, their statements, their mantras. In other words, we will build some strong army, and we'll never have to bow our hands down. And instead of saying it was because of God's punishment that we suffered, that we were spread throughout the diaspora, they said it's because of our physical problem, and we will correct that now. It happens to be that it's a very clear in Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs of King Solomon, that it states that the Almighty warned us with a. This is a prophecy of King Solomon. He built the temple, and he said that God said, "I'm putting you under three oaths when you're going to be driven into exile. One, if you do not attempt to return en masse in large numbers. Secondly, do not rebel against any nations. A Jew has to be a loyal citizen in every country where he is residing. Thirdly, do not make any attempt to end exile, because God foresaw there'll be people impatient and, you know, with our suffering through exile, the trials and tribulations. Zionism was almost entirely created by non-religious Jews such as Theodor Herzl and his cohorts. You had Ben-Gurion, Chaim Weizmann, which is a little, all these people detested the religion. Theodor Herzl wrote in his diaries, he wrote that the solution solution for Judaism, for our suffering, is to convert to Christianity. It should be done with music on page 14 of his diary and celebrate in St. Vienna in the St. Stephen's Cathedral on Sunday with music. So basically, they were trying to totally turn it on its head, this is what Judaism is, ignoring, excluding God from the equation. Yes, they're going to proudly say today that they're a democracy, that they allow religion, but not that it is. But ours is not a democracy. It's religion, subservience to God. Part of the religion is to have compassion, just as God is compassionate, not to steal, not to kill, and to show gratitude that if people did you good, such as the Muslim countries did for us, but they are totally turning it on its head to base material nationalism. All the rabbinical authorities universally, at the time of the inception of Zionism, stood, and we have a book in our site, NKUSA, you can look, all the rabbinical authorities worldwide, whether from Africa, from Middle East, from the Sephardic rabbis, Ashkenazic, from Europe and so forth, they all, as a whole, stood in opposition and said, this is directly in rebellion to God, this is indirectly antithetical to our Torah. One, we're not allowed to make our own Jewish sovereignty, even one inch of Jewish sovereignty, and it doesn't matter where. Even if we would be able to purchase a piece of land anywhere, and it would be in the total will of all humanity as a Jew, because we are accepting this as a medicine of God, like medicine sometimes is bitter. We are here on this world, and God gave us this medicine that we should be able to repent and better our ways, and therefore we will be worthy of what we yearn. And every Jew, if you look in the Jewish prayer books, we yearn for one thing. We pray constantly that ultimately the revelation of God's glory throughout the world, we believe then God will make a miracle without any human intervention, where all humanity will believe in the one God, and we will all serve Him. Then we will go up, and there will be King David's kingdom. It won't be a state of Israel, and that is the return of exile, the end of exile. Prior to that time, we are forbidden to make any attempts to have our own sovereignty. Certainly not to make this sovereignty by banishing, oppressing another people, throwing them out of their homes, killing, stealing. So in every facet, a concept of this Jewish sovereignty, so to say, this Jewish state, and especially in the Holy Land, where God sent us out and warned us not to return en masse there, this whole thing of Zionism flies in the face of Jewishism on every facet, and all the rabbinical authorities stood in opposition, and they warned us. King Solomon wrote in this prophecy, it's in the Song of Songs of King Solomon, chapter, it's repeated three times on chapter 2, verse 7. He warns us that if you will attempt, God forbid, to rebel against this godly decree, then the result will be catastrophic. And our rabbis warned us that Zionism will bring to catastrophic results. And we found that since this movement of Zionism, which is the ideology behind the State of Israel, it has only brought to bloodshed, not only for Palestinians, but for Jews. There's not 10 years that go by, even with all their dreams and their so-called, you know, the miracles that they claim they have, and then the Six-Day War miracles and all these things. And yet, every big splash that they're going to have, now it's going to be peaceful, you find death and suffering and no light at the end of the tunnel and just more hate and a growing exacerbation of anti-Semitism throughout the world, because people think that if you're Jewish, and the more Jewish you are, the more you support this ideology in the State of Israel. They've hijacked the name Israel, which is Jacob. They've hijacked the symbols of Judaism, the Star of David, etc. And it's clearly hypocritical, because you can even see for yourself, anybody could see this, that the fathers, the leaders of the Zionist movement almost entirely are non-religious, and they ridicule religion. I have full of writings to show you this, and we have a book that's called the Traditional Torah Opposition to Zionist Historical Documents. Traditional Torah Opposition to Zionism. Anybody could get it on our site. It's just a compilation of documents. We have even the documents, the statements of the Zionist leaders. I mean, some of it is just hair raising, and it's just not to be believed, okay, what they themselves said. So it's clearly antithetical to our Torah. Until today, invariably, in the very religious communities, you're in New York, you go to Williamsburg, right across from Manhattan. I'm sure you know the area. The Williamsburg Bridge crosses right over on the right side. Immediately after you cross the bridge into Brooklyn, Williamsburg, you'll find miles of the largest concentration of religious Jews, truly religious, and you won't find a single Israeli flag flying. Why? It's not because they're lacking in their Judaism. It's because they are very religious. They refuse to accept this rebellion against God, the existence of the state, and we cry. We're frustrated and humiliated by what is being done in our name to who? To the Palestinian people.
Rabbi Weiss,
yes.
I'm sure you have spent most of your life studying in depth the Torah, the Talmud, the Targums, the Midrashes, and the other Jewish texts, including the mystical texts. And you have given us a very good understanding of the difference between true Judaism and the messages of how it parts from the Zionist nationalistic doctrine of Israel. They saying that it's the promised land of the Jews and Jews alone, and it was made by God. You're saying that that is not true. We've also witnessed horrible atrocities and violence committed by Jews against Palestinians, by Palestinians against Jews, both Muslims and Christians, over the decades and since the first Zionists entered Palestine to start usurping the land. But neither do I condone, nor any reasonable person, that the Palestinian-Hamas violence against Jews and Israeli settlements is justified. Yet we tend to believe that terrorism originated among Arab and Muslim groups. I would like your perspective on that, because Menachem Begin, when he was prime minister, bragged that it was the Zionists who brought terrorism to both the Middle East and the world, and that's in writing. So give us a little history of the early Zionist terrorist movements during the early days of Israel's founding and how this continues today, and yet the American media, the American legislative process do not have the courage either to stand up or even the intelligence to read the true history.
Yeah, it's true. And like you prefaced what you're saying with saying that you don't condone violence, and unfortunately, because it's always whoever did this speaks up against the occupation right away is accused of not having feelings for suffering, you know, of any people. And of course, it's always necessary to state that, although it's so obvious. But the fact is, like you say, I'll have to say that also. It's very clear that we are not in any manner condoning violence, but it's simple, first of all, that this is a reaction. If somebody would take Rhode Island away from the U.S. or even one block of a town of the U.S. and say, because we need the area and you have such a, the United States is so great, and China or somebody would decide they needed a block, an area, nobody would rest still. Again, are we condoning the response? You know, we would, you know, go whatever the response is. That has nothing to do with the issue. The issue is that what has brought this about, what has incited this response, and if you want to, you're looking to have a remedy, then you don't keep on standing on the issue of what was the response, were you right with this response, because you know that at the end of the day you will never be able to silence the response of so many millions of human beings, because you can't tell everybody, follow my the way I think. But even if you're 100% right. But so we have to look at the root cause and say, let us take away the root cause, the sickness. And so that's why it is so critical to understand that this is the issue, that Zionism is the issue. It wasn't that we had a problem with religion. Jews were living in Palestine together with Muslims and Christians, mostly Muslims, and they were living in every Muslim land. And the fact that throughout history, which we're not going to get into now, of course, Jews found a safe haven in the Muslim lands. They opened their doors. We didn't have human rights groups to protect us, yet we flourished as religious Jews, distinctly religious amongst the different religion amongst the Muslim people. So it wasn't a difference of religion. In the same courtyards we lived, we babysat each other's children. And this was for hundreds of years. I have colleagues here amongst us here who lived in Palestine, yet they talk about what you're exactly saying, that the Zionists came And they, in order to be able to gain that area for their ideology, their, what I say, selfish and totally criminal and flawed, that they'll take over the land and just simply throw out those Palestinians that are there. So they use terrorist attacks. They use attacks. For Deir Yassin, for instance, is a prime example. What they went and they... they went into a village that was so friendly with the Jews. And I've heard this from my old Jewish colleagues amongst us, who their parents, and some of them still remember as children, that they were living in total harmony. They went in and they terrorized them. And the result was they ran away. And then they weren't allowed back. I mean, there was, you know, there was some of them were totally, wiped off the map, many, many villages. But the Zionists, their issue of the way they acted, they blew up the King David Hotel where the British were there. They went, and they not only that, but what they did to their fellow Jews. They went in. We have a book called Holocaust Victims, The Holocaust Victims Accused by Rabbi Moshe Schoenfeld of blessed memory. It's documents and testimony on Jewish war criminals. I could tell you that I could quote you what the in that book we have just some of them that they went. There was a book. There was Jews who were running away before the creation of the state. They were trying to. They were in refugee camps. They were barely just put out of the barracks of the in the Holocaust of Auschwitz and the others. The ones, the remnants, that are alive. But even prior to that, there were Jews who it was like 5, 6, 7 years that the Jews were being murdered in throughout the period of the World War II. The Nazis had started before in the 1930s. So there were some Jews who were able to escape prior to that. Now, in 1940, for instance, there was a ship called the Patria, and they came up. It was called with steamships called the Pacific and Milos, M-I-L-O-S, and they were they came up to the Palestinian coast. They had enough 1,771 refugees on that ship, and there was a fight between the Irgun and the Haganah. You know, who is going to be in control? What happened was. The British had a whole big problem because there was already, since the 1920s, there was this ongoing fight between the Zionists who had started coming up to Palestine at the beginning of the 20th century. So it was a very tense atmosphere. And the British didn't know what to do here. So the Haganah was, at that time fighting with the British and the Irgun and the Lehi. And so now this ship came up with these refugees. So the Haganah went and they blew up this ship. And this is this you can see all the documents of this. 10 years later, afterwards, the Haganah generals. I'm quoting it on page 62 of this book. 10 years after they blew up the ship, the Haganah general staff admitted. They said David Flinker wrote in November 27, 1950, in the New York Morning Freiheit. He wrote. I'm quoting, the English must be given to understand, the Patria must be blown up. And they went and they blew this up. It was some people say they said that they did this, that it should look as if the British is not in control. Some people say because they were having this inner fight about who was in control of the people coming in between the Irgun and the Haganah. They went up and they killed their own Jewish who had just barely survived from the Nazi, from Hitler, and they went and they blew them up. They did many acts of terrorism, and that's what they continued to do through our Jewish witnesses, what they did to the Palestinian people. And therefore, and they did this proudly, and they said that they were, this was their responsibility because it's their land. They're going to take over the land. So then afterwards, when they're claiming what the Palestinian people did, that it's something that it's their invention, totally wasn't their invention at all. It's, they were doing this, the Haganah and the Irgun and the Lehi. And we suffered from this. Until today, if you will go to our site again, you'll find links of full, till today, from that day, our leaders were being assassinated. The Jewish rabbis who stood up in opposition were assassinated in 1924. our greatest spokesperson, who was the spokesperson for the chief rabbi of Palestine, of Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, and this fellow's name was Dr. Dahan. He came from Denmark, and he was a very famous poet, and he was a very famous diplomat. He was a friend of the king, and in fact, they even have a statue of him in Denmark. The king escorted him when he decided to go to Palestine in the 1920s. He thought it meant to become a religious Jew. It meant to go to Palestine to become part of Zionism, because everybody thinks that's Judaism. He went there, but he was a serious person looking for the truth, and he met with the chief rabbis, and he saw that the true Judaism is anti-Zionist. So he went and he started pleading their case, because when under the British rule, since the First World War, the Britain decided to put the Zionists who came from their midst. The first president of Israel, his name was Chaim Weizmann, was awarded by the British the rights, basically, that they're going to help them, the Balfour Declaration, they're going to help them create a Jewish state. And therefore, they put a decree on the Jews in Palestine that everybody has to register under the Zionist movement. And all these Jews who were living there for hundreds of years, God-fearing, all of a sudden there was a decree from Britain that a Jew has to go under some religion, that's a supposed religion that's not even theirs. They refused to do this. So they were slaughtered. The Jews went to pleaded with the British mandate, and they were Dr. Dahan, they were freed on a certain technical way that they don't have to register under the Zionists. But what happened was, Dr. Dahan in 1924 he was warned by the Zionists, if he's not going to cease and desist, then they're going to assassinate him. And in their own writings, and it's well known, in front of Shaare Tzedek Hospital in 1924, they took this fellow, they shot him in the streets right in front of Shaare Tzedek in the middle of Jerusalem. And to silence, because he was a tremendous threat to them, he was supposed to be leaving a few days later to go speak in front of British Parliament to plead the case of the Jewish community. In 1947, a year before the ratification of the state, that Rabbi Sonnenfeld, who we mentioned earlier, had passed on, and the next rabbi was Rabbi Dushinsky. And in 1947, he went with a delegation of rabbis to the leadership of the United Nations, the delegation that was there in the Holy Land, July 16th, 1947, I'm just going to quote one sentence of his, they went and they said, "We furthermore wish to express our definite opposition to a Jewish state in any part of Palestine." And this declaration they handed over, and a lot of their meeting with and we have pictures of it, and it's in the United Nations documents, that they pleaded with the United Nations, they don't want a Jewish state, any type of Jewish state in any part of Palestine. They were ignored, and 4 months later, November 18th, 1947, again Rabbi Dushinsky, as chief rabbi, wrote a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations in Lake Success. And again, I'm just going to quote two sentences. He wrote, "The Jewish Orthodox community of Jerusalem, comprising 60,000 souls, object to the plea of including Jerusalem in the Jewish state or its residents becoming automatically citizens of the Jewish state. Our community demands that Jerusalem be an international zone under your protection, with full autonomy, its residents being free citizens of the international zone of Jerusalem. We beg of you not to take any action before receiving a memorandum, but signed by the chief rabbi, J.Z. Dushinsky." Now, Rabbi what he's doing was, he said, "I see that you're ignoring." They saw they were being ignored. They're going to make a state of Israel. So he said, "At least leave Jerusalem, that it should be an international zone." And he didn't say this because he was afraid of the fear of the repercussions and the bloodshed and the terrible result from Palestinians and Jews, simply because we don't want a Jewish state. It's against our religion. And also part of the religion is not to kill and not to steal. So this concept of a Jewish state is a farce. The Jewish community that was living there for hundreds of years, they were the citizens, of the indigenous Jewish population of Palestine. They were the ones who were pleading that they don't want a Jewish state. And I have to just about you saying about terrorism. Right after the First World War, there was a German general, and he wrote a book. The book is called "The Turks and Germans in Sinai." In German, it's called "Mit den Türken Suez Canal, with the Turks to the Suez Canal, by Friedrich Frierich Kress von Kressenstein. And there's a book review on this in the Haaretz, and it's in the Haaretz archives, and you can find that. And he wrote in the middle of the book review, which is in English, which is written by in Haaretz. They're writing just one paragraph, and he writes like this: It is interesting to see how Palestine of 90 years ago appeared to Kress. That's this German general. Now, again, this Kress was a German general, had no interest or reason to say anything that's not true about our Jewish community. And this is what he wrote. I'm quoting, "A phenomenon that was extremely odd was how the war, the First World War, caused an unprecedented upsurge in the battle between the Zionists and non-Zionists. That is, a battle that turned ugly and did little to promote Jewish interests in general. At the same time, the non-Zionists, that is the Jews without political goals, mainly belonging to the Orthodox stream, were the overwhelming majority in Palestine. The Zionists living in Palestine scarcely made up 5% of the population, but they were very active and fanatical and terrorized the non-Zionists. During the war, that's the First World War, the latter, that's the non-Zionists, tried to free themselves from this terror with the help of the Turks. They feared, justifiably, that the activities of the Zionists would ruin the good relations that existed between the longtime Jewish inhabitants of Palestine and the Arabs, and so forth. So I'm just showing you that terrorism started way back. They were the ones who introduced it. And ironically, against who did they introduce it? Not only the Arabs, but against the Jews. My colleagues, they quote and they keep on saying how they grabbed the Jewish youth from the streets to force them to fight for them. When the Jews, the refugees, were coming off the boats by World War II, and they were deathly sick, they were skin and bones, they put guns in their hands and said, go, you have to go fight now, because these are the continuation of the Nazis, the ones that are, you know, and they didn't even know how to use these guns, and they died, and because they were put up front there by these Zionists, and they forced our Jewish youth to go. And till today, as you know, maybe they're forcing Jews who are ready to give their lives, they're trying to force them into their army. And you may have seen there's tens of thousands of Jews demonstrating in the streets of Jerusalem that they're going to rather die than go into their military, and yet they brutally beat them constantly. And this they've been doing for over 50 years, and over almost 100 years, but since the state is over 60 years, they constantly brutally beat, but they beat us in another manner. They use rubber truncheons with lead filled with lead that you don't see outside what they're doing, that the bones get broken inside. They arrest, they terrorize, and this is what they do constantly to our Jewish people. And the ones who are our leaders, they assassinate. Many of our rabbis, for instance, the head of Neturei Karta, the voice of the Jews United Against Zionism, he had to go for a hernia operation. The chief rabbi of Palestine, Rabbi Joel Teitelbaum, at the time, in the 1960s, this was around, and he pleaded with him, don't go to the hospital, but he said he should leave Palestine, but he didn't want to use an Israeli passport, and he had no other way of getting to a place to, and he had to go to a hospital. So he went into the hospital. Within that day, they announced that he had died from internal bleeding. And this is ongoing. This was a person who was like built like a tree, a strong, big man. So, I mean, terrorism is there.
Rabbi Weiss, you have given us a great deal to understand. And just as a final thought for this segment, when we consider something that confuses people, for example, how did it get started in the United States, we have to realize that Zionism was very popular back in the early part of the 19th century in the 20th century. In fact, you could have as many as 10,000 Zionists back around 1910 to 20,000, and they were sympathizers. They were in the professions, lawyers, professors, and businessmen. And by the mid-1920s, almost every Yiddish publication in New York was Zionist. And that led to the Zionism in the United States being a very strong influence to persuade the United States to sign and ratify the UN Declaration for the Israeli nation. And yet we only know one side of the picture. You have shown us a glimpse at the other side. And your website has all the publications, writings, and documentation to let people know that there's two sides to this. The website, let me give you the initials, nkusa.org. And I want to thank you for all your good work and having the courage, along with the other hundreds of rabbis that protest against the inhumanity that we see. Your issue is you want a world of peace. You also want the Palestinians to have peace and the capacity to live in peace. And the way it's going now, that won't happen. And that's why we need to have voices such as yours being heard. Thank you very much for being with us from Monsey, New York.
Thank you. God bless.
I'm Gary Knoll. This has been our program today on political Zionism versus religious Judaism. Hopefully, many of you will better understand now why, before you make a judgment, you should do your homework, look for the truth, and don't trust the American media to be the purveyors of that truth.